accession number 28496, Reel 2.
So Whitley Reel 2. So what happened when you'd been in the holding camp? Were you assigned to a ship?
Yes, we were assigned, first of all, to 819 Squadron at Ford, and we formed a squadron at Ford in new aircraft. We were, all the NCOs were Air Force, all the air crew were Navy, and we formed up at Ford. We worked up at West Frew up in Scotland, and then two of us were sent with two aircraft to fly up to Speke, and we were dragged through the streets of Liverpool to the Gladstone dock and hoisted aboard aircraft Illustrious for the flying HMS Illustrious for the flying trials. And we were both 18, and we went out of Gladstone dock into a pub called the Caradoc. We'd never been in a dockyard pub before. We fled back to the ship. And we went to sea eventually, and I'd been told to ballast the aircraft for the trials. And when we started it up, and I was putting the starting handle in its holder in the back cockpit, and the pilot said, "Get in." But I said, "Please, sir," the CO said, and he said, "Get in." Fortunately, there was still a harness in the aircraft. So I have the distinction of being a passenger in the first aircraft that ever landed on the ship.
What aircraft was it?
Swordfish. One, it was one of our own squadron, 819 Squadron.
So 819 were equipped with Swordfish?
Yes.
You mentioned they're ballasting the aircraft. How would you do that?
Well, there were fittings which you dropped circular lead weights over. There was sort of a tube, and you could drop these weights over the tube and then put something on the top so that they didn't come out if the aircraft turned over. And the idea was really that if there was no crew member in the rear cockpits, you put in the ballast a little bit further off, so it didn't actually put in the weight of the missing crew member, but that kept the weight of the aircraft balanced. I think in the Swordfish, I don't think it mattered, because the fact that he did the deck landing trials with the ballast and me, and that the aircraft had an overload tank in the middle cockpit, I think perhaps we were being a bit fussy with the Swordfish.
How did that feel to do those deck landing trials? Well, what was the experience like, obviously, flying in an aircraft and those landings?
Well, it was a bit odd, really, because it was very early in the morning and I'd had no breakfast. And as the aircraft was circling, the ship seemed to be steaming up and downhill and so on, and you watch the attendant destroyer moving in, and then you make an approach, and because you couldn't see for this tank between yourself and the pilot, and because you had no contact with him, because you didn't have a helmet and you didn't know whether he plugged in the Gosport tubes or anything, you sort of braced yourself, and then you saw the ship going by because you realised that it was having a dummy run. And then I think because the Swordfish was a light aircraft, the arresting was reasonably gentle, and we did two or three landings, and then somebody came up and said, "I don't want you to go over the side, old boy, but see how near the edge you can land," and he was off again before I could get out. But fortunately the wire swung us inboard, so we did a series of trials, and then we went up to Greenock, and eventually we flew off the ship and went back to Roeburgh. And because the ship was coming down to Plymouth, and then the rest of the squadron was at Roeburgh, and we embarked in Illustrious, I suppose it must have been June, with 815, the other Swordfish squadron, and 806, which at that stage had the skuas. And we went to Bermuda on a shakedown cruise, and we hit some very rough weather. And in those days, all the heads' toilets were in the forward end of the ship under the roundown. And they still had scuttles or portholes, not like the later ships, who never had any. And some of these had been knocked in by the bad weather, and there were lumps of timber bracing them up. And I sat there, and a piece of 4x2 whistled over my head. So I spent a lot of time in the ship looking for alternative toilets. And we came back from Bermuda, went up to John Brown's yard in Glasgow, because there'd been a bit of damage to the ship with the bad weather.
What type of damage was it?
Well, we had degaussing gear. which was to make the ship safe against magnetic mines, and this was new, and it was welded on the outside of the ship. We lost some of that, and of course a lot of scuttles and things have been stove in with the forward end of a carrier is so flared that if you get heavy sea, it really batters it. And then we did a stint there, and then off we went to sea again, up to Scapa Flow, out to the Med. And
before we do that, can I just ask a little bit, could you give me a kind of description of the characteristics of the swordfish, and you know how that reflects on what you were doing at the time, how you found it to work with and that sort of thing?
Well, it's very, very easy to work with, because you could get at most things on it without too much trouble. And we were certainly over-servicing them as the war went on, and it wasn't until many years afterwards that the Navy sorted out this problem. But for example, if you did a minor inspection every 30 flying hours, which in peacetime would have been weeks, you did that in a week in the war, and you were sort of taking out the dinghies and blowing them up and making sure they were all right every couple of weeks. But the swordfish was a great aircraft. You put your toolkit in it. They were even seen with motorbikes slung on the torpedo racks. And they're a pretty viceless aircraft, from the aircrew point of view. And we just got to know them, and as I say, you could chuck your kit in the back and off you went. And in the Med, we used to fly off to Dequila when the ship was in harbour, and we'd fly back and forward with the aircraft. And you got used to them, and quite happy.
What about its speed? Was it a fast aircraft?
Oh, no. It was very, very slow. I ended up very quickly as a supervisory rate in Illustrious. There were four of us. Ex-apprentices went to 819 Squadron, and we'd all passed out with a high mark at Holton, which mentioned that you could be a leading aircraftman in the Air Force in 6 months. Now, I think the Navy thought we would be... They made us leading air fitters in 6 months. Well, a leading hand in the Navy is equivalent to a corporal in the Air Force. So very, very quickly, we became supervisory rates. The Air Force corporals left, and we were the first stage of supervision for these aircraft very, very quickly.
Where were you accommodated on board?
We had a mess deck, which was down on the waterline, hammocks, standard Navy mess, rails for hammocks, banks of lockers for your kit, long tables out from the ship's side with forms to sit on, and a rack on the ship's side for the knives and forks and spoons and things. And you went up to the galley and carted down the food and shared it out. And
was it MS for just fleet or the people who were dealing with the aircraft?
It was all a fleet airline. We were all together with the air mechanics and the fabric bashers and the power jewel packers. You know, we were all together. I mean, the petty officers and sergeants had a separate mess, obviously.
And how were relations with the seamen on board the ship who did the sort of day-to-day tasks on board?
Well, it's they used to sort of pull our legs, and mainly one of the problems we had was we didn't work watches. We seemed to be working all the time, and we couldn't wash our overalls and get them nice and pretty and pale blue like the sailors, and they used to pull our leg for that. But they worked a completely different system, the watchkeeping system. This was all right, and I think they were all very proud in the ship. We had a very good captain.
What about maintenance facilities? Where would you do the maintenance on there?
Well, in the hangar. Illustrious had a hangar was armour plate on the flight deck, armour plate doors forward and aft, and the bulkheads on the ship's side, and it was divided into three by fire screens, and it was quite difficult because you didn't have very much space, and in fact, if you lost an aircraft, it was a relief because it meant that you had room to fiddle the things around. And the last three that went into, there were rows of three with their wings folded, the last three into the hangar, two of them were pushed out on rails into the corners of the hangar. And of course the hangar surface was steel, parts of it were hot because of machinery spaces and so on underneath it. And the stores were overhead, and a lot of aircraft spares were lashed in the deckhead. And you're really working in very, very close confines, and noisy, hot. But I mean, you got used to. But when we had to sleep there at sea, because our mess was on the waterline, so we used to sleep on camp beds, and occasionally you'd wake up and think this is a hard camp bed, and you realise you'd fallen off it. They were quite the little low ones, you know. Those canvas ones with tubes in.
But the fire screens, what were they made of?
They were, unfortunately, metal, like those shutters you see down in front of shops. And when the ship was bombed, they were shredded. And they went through the hangar, doing an awful lot of damage. And later ships, the curtains were asbestos.
With the aircraft in the hangar, would you have to sometimes maneuver two or three of them to move just one aircraft up to the lift?
Oh gosh, yes. We used to call it hangar drafts. And it was all done by hand at that stage. We didn't have tractors, which on later carriers. So you push them all, and they went up on the lift, and you pushed them down to the after end of the flight deck when they were flying. And we had seamen in the squadron, and they were on the guns, I think, and they would help. But you didn't want too much help, because if people didn't know what they were doing, they could damage the aircraft.
I was going to ask that question. How can people damage the aircraft like that when they do it? Is it a matter of pushing the wrong thing?
Yes.
Placing the weight in the wrong place?
That's right. It didn't matter with modern metal aircraft. I mean, there's always the danger from propellers when they're turning and so on, and there's always the danger that you get your foot caught under a wheel, particularly if you're pushing on the root of the wing when they're folded. But the fabric aircraft, it was quite easy to damage them, and you sometimes wish you weren't getting any help.
Was it a dangerous place in the hangar and on the flight deck?
The flight deck's very dangerous. In fact, if you fall on a flight deck, you're supposed to stay there. That's if the aircraft are there and running. I mean, if there's nothing happening, it doesn't matter. I found you seem to get your feet seem to get blown from under you, because there's always the window of the flight deck. And the rules were, if you fell, you didn't do anything, and somebody would come and tell you if it was okay to get up. We had a chap joined us in Bermuda. He was hit by a propeller. It was extremely easy to walk into a propeller, and later on, of course, it was extremely easy to get either blown down by a jet efflux or get sucked into a jet. And choppers became a danger, particularly with the tail rotor. So you had to be very, very careful and watch what you were doing. And sometimes there'd be funnel fumes over the deck, and sometimes you could smell the bacon cooking, and it was a relief when you got turned into wind, because it was fresh air, although it was moving very fast.
What would your kind of daily routine be there? Because you said you seem to be working all the time.
Oh, gosh. Get up to make the dawn range. Get the anti-submarine aircraft for patrol, and then you'd perhaps nip away and get some breakfast. And then they would fly all day, and the flying was organised so that the air crew always had their meals. So it was a long, drawn-out business. And you flew until it got dark. And then you did the servicing, or role change, or preparing the aircraft for an operation, for example. They occasionally went off to bomb places at night, besides doing the anti-submarine patrols. And sometimes they went out to attack a convoy. And it was a very, very long day. I was so tired that I once put my camp bed underneath an aircraft. It had three anti-submarine bombs under the on the wing, right over my camp bed. There were people fiddling around in the cockpit of the aircraft, and I couldn't be bothered moving. And when I woke up next morning, the aircraft had gone, and somebody had done my stint up on the flight deck, because I was in the pin party, which leapt on the aircraft and folded the wings when they landed and spread them before they took off.
Can you explain to me how the wings are secured and how the pins work in there?
Varies from aircraft to aircraft. With a Swordfish, it had a centre section in the top wing and two stub planes at the bottom with the undercarriage attached. And the aircraft rear spars, top and bottom, were hinged, and when you pulled the aircraft forward, part of the spar went over attachments on the stubs, and then you pulled down a handle on the strut between the wings, and that shoved a high tensile steel pin into the holes and locked the thing on. And when you pushed the handle down, it clipped onto something so that it didn't vibrate loose. And there was a V-strut underneath the tailplane to which you attached the wingtip of the aircraft when it was in the folded position.
Were there ever any accidents with the pins and the wings folding in flight?
No, not to my knowledge. I mean, there were cases sometimes with aircraft later on when they became mechanical, folding and so on. There have been cases, I mean, you've seen a photograph of a Hornet going off the end of a carrier with the wing going up, but this was very, very unusual.
With these working these long hours,
yeah.
Were you physically and mentally tired during that period, would you say?
Oh, yes. Yes, I'd gone sick because I was so tired, and the MO said, why don't you go ashore and get some beer? I don't really thought we did. The Taranto attack was put back because of a hang of fire, which I think may well have been caused by a tired sailor who, I think they dropped an armoured fuel hose across a battery in the middle cockpit of the Swordfish, and it started a fire. Yes, we were, and you just got on with it. I mean, obviously, later on, they must have realised, because later on there were shifts, so that you had enough people to work nights and so on. But this was during the war. This didn't happen during our time. But then the time that Illustrious was in operation, our squadron only lasted exactly a year. And Illustrious was in the Mediterranean for only about four months before she was bombed.
Well, if we can take that through from you arriving in the Mediterranean,
yeah.
What were the first operations that were taking place from the carrier?
There were raids against the Dodecanese Islands, where the Italian aircraft were based. And they also did some work, there were sort of skirmishes up and down the desert, and some of those were supported. Oddly enough, I read about, when I was living here, about wartime mining, and one of the most successful airborne mining operations was done by 19 Squadron in the Mediterranean when they were based ashore in Tequila, and the sort of number of ships sunk for the number of mines sowed was the best ever. Most of the work, though, the daily work was anti-submarine patrols all day while the ship was at sea.
How did you, what were the relationship like between yourselves maintaining the aircraft and the crews?
The aircrew were mainly peacetime naval officers. There were some ex-Air Force officers amongst them because, the transfer. When you're starting a new service, you need both flyers and maintainers, so quite a lot of transferring took place. And there was quite a big gulf between an ordinary naval person and the officers in those days. But they knew how much work we were doing, because they would sometimes come up the hangar with some lime juice. And on the Taranto operation, when we lost aircraft with water in the petrol on the day of the raid, the aircrew were helping prepare the aircraft.
Well, maybe if we could go through a little bit, you know, step by step, the Taranto raid and what your role was, getting the aircraft ready for it and that.
Well, we were not told a great deal, you know, for security in the war. And the first I knew about the raid on Taranto was we had a blackboard in the far end of the corner of the hangar where the aircraft loads and so on were listed when there was an operation, and it was headed Blitz on Taranto with a list of the aircraft. Eagle should have been at sea on that operation, but she had mechanical problems, so some of Eagle's aircraft were in the ship at the same time. And all the aircraft were prepared for the operation. In my case, I think about four of the six aircraft that I was supervising then were going. And another job I had was these torpedoes had an air tail which controlled their angle of drop. And this was attached to some drum control gear behind the tag, the air gunner's cockpit, which was a shaft with a weight on it, and two spools of 21.5 feet of cable were on this thing, and they went down and were tied to the end of the air tail. And one of my jobs was to wind all these, which I did by hand. So, and then when everything was ready, some of the aircraft that were flying went into the sea with the water and the petrol, and nobody knew which aircraft had been refilled at which of the filling points, so we had no option but to drain them all. To drain them all, you had to take off the armament, which was already on them, and the torpedo, because you wanted to get the drain plugs, which were underneath the fuel tanks. You also had to lift the aircraft into flying or rigging position so that all the fuel would go out. And we had to drain all the fuel out of all these aircraft, refill them through chamois leathers, which is a long and tedious business, and then put back all the panels and the armament for the raid. And as I said earlier on, the aircrew were helping, which I thought was a bit hard on them, as they were going to spend all night flying. And eventually we got them all ready. And 815 and some of Eagle's aircraft did the first wave, and they disappeared and flew off. And then we got our aircraft on the flight deck, and our aircraft were taking off, and till we got to the last two, and they both moved forward together to the deck officer's signal, and they met. And the aircraft, Clifford and Goings' aircraft, was on the centre line. The Morford was flying an aircraft with a centre line tank instead of a torpedo. Anyway, the Swordfish had a slat on the top wing, which was metal, and it made an enormous hole in the bottom of the wing of Clifford and Goings' aircraft. And Haggis Russell said, "Which aircraft can go and which can't?" And I said, "That one can and that one can't." And Morford took off, and Clifford and Goings disappeared up the flight deck, saying, "Let's go and ask the captain if we can go after them." And I thought, they must be mad. Second wave. The first wave was waking everybody up in Taranto, and then in the second wave, and then they go in afterwards. So we pushed the aircraft down in the hangar, and a quick look inside the hole, and the wing structure, the spars and the bracing tubes and the bracing wires are all okay. So we push all the broken ribs back into the wing and dope on an enormous fabric patch and take the aircraft back on the flight deck, and off they went after the rest. And then we all sat back, never expecting to see any aircraft back, or at least not many of them. Sammy Morford came back first because his tank on the torpedo rack had fallen off. And so he came back. And then later on, the rest of them started coming back, and we couldn't believe it. We got them all back except two. And then, of course, you began to find out what had happened, and it was very exciting, and particularly when we got back to Alexandria, and there were the headlines in the papers, you know.
So, had you heard from any of the aircrew? Had that filtered down to you how well it had gone?
I think the trouble is that the way that you handle the aircraft in those days, they landed on, the barrier went up, and you wanted the aircrew out of the aircraft so you could fold them up and get them down. So they used to disappear in the dark, and you didn't really get anything, you know. It's dark, and there's a howling gale, and all you're interested in is making sure they get out before the wings chop right off, you know.
Were any of the aircraft damaged that you dealt with? In the
game? Oh yes, none of mine. All the aircraft that I have were all got back all right, but John Wellham is still around, one of the Eagle pilots. He had an enormous hole in the bottom wing of his aircraft, and he had quite a bit of difficulty flying it. And this hole in Goering's aircraft would have got worse if they'd tried to fly off as it was. So it was, in a way, a great surprise. And, of course, you never realised at the time that operation had changed naval warfare overnight. And, of course, those of us who are still around, I stopped now. We used to go to Trento dinners every year. And I remember a chap who became an admiral. You heard him say, "We never expected to get free dinners for life."
Was it... A good thing, though, for the service, do you think, the success of the Taranto raid, it was seen as...
Oh, yes.
...newfangled aircraft carriers were going to be...
Oh, I'm sure it was. Because there were very few medals awarded, and I've read later something by Cunningham that he didn't realise the full importance of everything. Or words to that effect, not exactly the same as that. But I think the Navy been dining Trafalgar for hundreds of years, and the Fleet Air have been dining Taranto now for 60 years.
Were there any other operations at that time that spring to mind as being?
There was a convoy operation that was done in December 1940, which I remember because the pilots who had been the pilot when we did the first landing on the Illustrious was lost on it, so Lieutenant Garton Stone. You all seem to fly with the same pilots, and I'd been a passenger for a lot of time with him, and he was lost on this operation. What I'd really like to do, I think, is buy a copy of the squadron diary from the records office to remember what all the operations are, because I also remember doing a raid on Benghazi. I had trouble getting locking the pin, and the aircraft started moving up the flight deck, and I thought, I'm going to go into Benghazi backside first, you know, but then the aircraft stopped and I got the thing locked and I got off.